Welcome to the McGuffman. I'm Alex, and with me, burping, is James.
Hello. Hello.
Just before we get started, we want you to check out our website. We've put out a lot of good content recently, which is starting to become the norm, apparently. Our most recent podcasts are about adaptation. The podcast we did last week, Being John Malkovich, was the podcast we did the week before. And I think if you can follow the line of those topics, you'll be able to figure out what we're talking about today. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMcGuffinMen, probably, or just search The MacGuffinMen. And follow us on Twitter, at The MacGuffinMen, all one word, no underscores, nothing like that. And yeah, if you like our podcast, please do tell a friend, tell five friends, and get them to subscribe on iTunes. Anyway, theme song time.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James, we're back. Karen O performed the theme song. Here we are.
Is that true?
Karen O and the kids.
We got Karen for this?
Yeah, we did. It's crazy. Sounds a lot like Emily. But what movie are we talking about today, James?
We're talking about Where the Wild Things Are.
Cool.
A very highly anticipated movie, I guess.
Yeah. For a number of reasons. People love the book, Where the Wild Things Are.
People love that
book. It's weird, right?
I can't think of a picture book that would even come close.
No.
Like a child's illustrated book,
yeah,
of a book that's universally respected and appreciated, and from 1963. And I remember it still being like huge for when I was a kid and all my friends and things like that. That was, mm-hmm, just a standard book that everyone had and everybody loved.
Mm-hmm. See, I assumed I read it at some point. And like when I flipped through it, when this movie was coming out, our roommate at the time had it, and I was flipping through it and I was like, yeah, this looks familiar, but I don't definitely know I had a copy of it or anything.
Okay.
But then I was also thinking about like what children's books did I have, and I couldn't come up with a lot. I assume there was a lot of Dr. Seuss involved. I know there was a lot of Roald Dahl, but I don't remember Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah. It's come up as number one on a bunch of surveys and polls as best children's book or animated children's book ever. It's like 10 sentences long.
Yeah,
it's like 330 words in the whole thing, and it has this massive following and this huge impact. That's pretty incredible considering how little content there actually is in the source material, but how famous it is. And there's different kinds of adaptations of it. There's like short films, there's an opera, and then eventually in 2009 we got Spike Jonze's feature length adaptation of it. And yes, I said a very highly anticipated movie, and for the reason that the source material is so well respected, and Spike Jonze, who is, you know, very well respected from critics and the public alike, and this was a big pet project of his. So when it came out, a lot of the anticipation was just kind of for Spike Jonze's next work.
Exactly. And I mean, Adaptation came out in 2002. This Where the Wild Things Are finally came out in 2009. So, I mean, that's a big period of time. And Spike Jonze had been attached to the project since like 2003 or something like that.
Yeah, it went through kind of a few different ideas and who, like what studio was going to do it and how they were going to do it animation wise. But yeah, Spike Jonze was the name that was attached to it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And what we got is the movie we watched. And how did you feel about it? You had never seen it before.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember having this book and reading it a lot as a kid. And as we talked about in the other Spike Jonze podcast, we did. I like a lot of the stuff that he did. And I guess we should just mention all the music videos and other things that...
Yeah,
he's known for.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they will come up. But yeah, he sort of got his start in skate videos was part of it, and also predominantly music videos, like through the 90s. I mean, the Buddy Holly video, Sabotage by the Beastie Boys, which was a really playful video.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the list is pretty amazing. I mean, Drop by the Far Side, that's like my favorite music video ever, and so much fun to watch. And There is sort of a real sort of feeling of play, which is very present in Where the Wild Things Are.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, no, to your question of how I felt about it, it was kind of what I expected. I knew it was not going to be a children's movie. It's much more a movie about childhood than a kid's movie. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah. I was reading an interview with Spike Jonze, and he talked about talking to Maurice Sendak and very, very early. Who wrote the book. Very early discussions they had when Spike was still kind of unsure about how he was going to do it or if he was even going to do it. I can't totally remember, but Maurice Sendak said to him, "I don't really view myself as a children's book author. I just try and write about childhood as honestly as I can." And that sort of feels like the thought process that really sort of permeates the whole movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember hearing while this movie was in production that they showed it to a test group of kids and they all got terrified and they had to recut it to make it, you know, a bit more child friendly. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say this is a scary movie, but I can see how this project would give off that vibe of being kind of too much for young kids, especially.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's kind of telling that the movie wasn't marketed predominantly to kids either.
Yeah.
And so that's a big part of it. And I agree that I don't think it's particularly scary, but it's dark, like literally dark.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And the wild things don't look like heroes from kids movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They look like they're kind of built around that idea, but then somebody punched them all in the face five times and just sort of messed things up a little bit, you know?
And overall, it's not a pleasant movie. Like it starts off with him having kind of he's a very precocious, temperamental child, but him, kind of being bullied or something going wrong with his older sister's friends and the snowball fight at the intro and them collapsing the snow fort when he's in it, which is just really the claustrophobic scene where he's covered up and his snow forts or his igloo, what he calls it, is collapsed on himself and all the weights on top of him. That's extremely unpleasant. I'm not a claustrophobic person in particular, but that's awful. Like that's not a pleasant moment. And then we do get kind of some sweet moments in the first 20 minutes of between him and his mother and him telling her a story, which is, you know, and she writes it down, which is all very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's about her boss not being happy with her, about him having kind of an unpleasant time with the older kids.
About going to school and the teacher giving a speech about how the son is dying. Which is so funny.
The imminent end of the life on this planet.
I've never seen that actor in anything else, but I think he's so good in that scene.
Yeah,
just so weird funny.
There's lots of very dark, heavy things. And it's weird because that does kind of line up with the book. I think the movie definitely takes it further and is darker and more unpleasant than the book.
Mm.
And just kind of by the natures of the medium, it's kind of a lot easier to be very unsettling in film just because it's so all-encompassing and engaging. Like you have the music, you have, all these different elements that you can do. So you get that from the book, but it's definitely a lot stronger in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still kind of a book about childhood rage and isolation and, you know, these dark things where you can see how the movie went as dark as it did.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And the fact that, I don't know, like, I feel like the people involved, Dave Eggers co-wrote the script as well.
Yeah.
And Spike Jonze, I just sort of feel like you weren't going to get, like, the happiest movie about childhood, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though I feel like both of those people are very fun and lovable people, you know? Like, it's just sort of not the way that their media tends to skew.
Yeah, exactly. And even Karen O and the Yeah's, like, I think they make very good music, but it's not always super bright, fun, poppy stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, definitely when I see those people interviewed or when you read, you know, Dave Eggers' stuff, he's got some kind of lighthearted, funnier stuff. He's a funny human being, but yeah, in their work, it's usually about something heavier than that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What did you think about the actual way that the wild things are presented? Like the costumes and all that.
I thought that was fantastic. Yeah. I thought that was really good. And one of Spike Jonze's things, we see this in adaptation, we see it in Being John Malkovich, is doing a good job with special effects. Mm-hmm. And he always has, well, not always, but he often has, you know, whether it be CGI or animatronics or puppetry or just some other kind of, you know, visuals, some other kind of acting. It's all done very seamlessly, and I thought this was fantastic as far as that regard.
Yeah, he's very big on doing things in camera, and
yes,
and that's very prominent in this film.
Yeah,
The initial plan was to do everything in camera, but it didn't work out. Like the faces are digital,
right. Okay.
And because the people couldn't, apparently the stunt performers couldn't walk in a straight line with the heads on because they were so heavy. Spike was really wanted to do everything practically, but he was actually convinced by David Fincher, who was making Benjamin Button at the time. It's like, you're an idiot if you do these faces digitally, or sorry, if you don't do these faces digitally, because you have to carry all this equipment around, and you know, just makes everything so much harder. So Spike still wasn't convinced, and then Fincher showed him a bunch of test footage from Benjaboo, and Spike was like, "Okay, we'll do the digital faces, because everything but the face is real in, you know, the majority of the shots."
And Spike was attached to Benjamin Button for a bit, right? Or was approached for it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think he turned it down.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. With the wild things, the creatures, whatever. I thought it did an excellent job of getting across what the book does about having these friendly things be also terrifying at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I was reading Maurice Sendak talking about his inspiration for the book and how it was based on his aunts and his uncles and his cousins and stuff that used to come over and visit. And, you know, they're these things that are friendly towards you, but they're so big and confusing, and when you're a kid, it's adults are just so otherworldly, like it's you don't get it at all. And I think this movie does a good job of them being, you know, so unique, so out there, but friendly and playful when they want to be, but also so terrifying and bewildering when we see Max first get to the world where the wild things are, and they're threatening to eat him and things like that. It's not a movie for children, but it's such a good job of kind of representing childhood and a lot of those feelings of, you know, fear and confusion and isolation and loneliness. Mm-hmm. And I think the creatures themselves look, you know, really flawless. I find like I never really got caught up in what they look like from a negative aspect. So yeah. I think I'm not nuts about this movie, but it's definitely not the creatures, and it's definitely not the visuals that detract.
No, from me. I think like the way the wild things are portrayed in this movie is perfect. Like I can't think of anything I would change to make it better. And even just sort of the way it sort of feels like there was room for you know, as much improvisation as you can sort of pull off in this movie, particularly in montages and stuff like that, where, you know, you might see someone like bounce off a line or something and just do something that sort of feels like it wasn't in the script, you know, just sort of go another way with something. And part of that, I'm sure, is sort of to the way the camera moves in the movie. I mean, it's all handheld and often things are sort of given a sort of more, a bit shakier look just to make it feel more improvised. But I do feel like the people in the suits definitely had some room to roam with their stuff. Even when there's that scene when Judith, who's the Catherine O'Hara wild thing, has been in an argument with Max and KW, and they're walking away, and she calls out, "I'm talking to you." And then Max looks back and she's like, "No, not you. I'm still talking to KW."
Yeah.
And even if that, I'm sure certain that was scripted, but like it sort of feels like a moment that wasn't scripted. And I think there are tons of those moments in this movie, and whether or not they're scripted or not, I think kind of, if they're scripted, it might even make it more impressive, because it really sort of adds to this feel of just sort of existing in a world. And I think that's what the goal of the movie was. And because, you know, it's not plot heavy.
I just read the synopsis of this. I was like, what am I reading? Like, what is happening?
Throw snowballs, gets in fight with mom, goes to place, comes back from place, end film. You know, sorry, goes on emotional journey. Put that sentence somewhere in there. But yeah, and I think that I always like movies that can pull off something like that, that can sort of exist without without a standard plot and still be engaging. And I think this movie does that. And a big part of that has to do with the fact that, well, I mean, the movie rests on the shoulders of the Wild Things and Max. And for the majority of the movie, they're the only people in it and are only characters in it.
Once Mark Ruffalo's gone.
Yeah. And yeah, and I just sort of feel like the movie's not perfect, but I think for what it tries to do, I think it's a really enjoyable movie. And I did not remember liking it as much as I enjoyed watching it again. I thought it was really good. And I think that sort of sense of play and just sort of existence in, you know, just in this place is so important to my enjoyment of the movie, because that's a thing that I don't find in a lot of movies that is very present in here.
Yeah, and that line about, you know, I'm still talking to you. The moments that are funny in this movie really catch me off guard. Like, it definitely has some funny parts. I wouldn't, you know, it's not a comedy. I wouldn't say it's a very funny movie or anything, but just because of the otherworldly nature of everything going on, when there is kind of a very real human moment like that, where it's, you know, just a simple misunderstanding, or just, you know, someone trips up on something they're saying, it seems very genuine, and it's very immediate. And I mean, just going thematically with being a movie about childhood, if anything, is immediate. Like, it's about what's happening right then and there. Yeah. And when you say it, there's kind of that improvised feel to a lot of these things, that when we consider the amount of work that went into this visually, probably not much could be, you know, really ad-libbed and done organically, but it definitely still gives away that feel. And that just lines up with so perfectly with what kind of things we're dealing with in this movie.
Yeah. And the way the actual, the voices of the Wild Things and stuff were captured is, it's very similar to the way that Wes Anderson did the Fantastic Mr. Fox. It had the actors sort of engaging with each other, not in a sound booth doing their lines by themselves, but sort of on a stage and interacting with each other. And Max, you know, depending on who was around or who was the most convenient, Max or would be played by Spike Jonze or Catherine Keener in these scenes, just give the Wild Thing somebody to interact with. And and I mean, when we talked about Fantastic Mr. Fox, we talked about how that gives a real natural feel to the performances. And in a type of movie that often, like, these characters aren't the natural performance, you know? And like the Fantastic Mr. Fox and like the Wild Things in this movie, there's never something, I don't know, they just sort of, like, they feel like they're actors in the suits, not suits they're moving and then voices being pasted on them, you know? And I that really ties into what I was saying before. And it's sort of this really, really important aspect of the feel of the film, I find.
Yeah, and just James Gandolfini's voice acting in this, I thought was really good. And it's weird to see him, I don't know, he plays, like, for so much of this movie, he's just broken and upset. Yeah. And, you know, we think of him, you know, everyone's mind with James Gandolfini immediately goes to Tony Soprano as kind of, you know, this big hulking guy who's in charge of all these people doing, you know, awful and violent crimes to each other. Mm. And he's pretty much just another stand-in for Max in this movie. He's, you know, the most childish character in a movie about childhood, arguably, other than Max. So, it's just interesting juxtaposition to see him on that level. And I think he does a very good job with it, but it's interesting because we have, you know what I mean? He's basically Max again. Like, this whole movie.
KW's his mom, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, there's very clear analogies between everyone we see in the first, what is it, probably 20 minutes while he's still in the real world and all the Wild Things. So, yeah, it's, as I said before, it's a movie that's kind of just dissecting childhood anger. Like, it's this really, really seemingly unpleasant idea that is executed in, I would say, visually a very beautiful way in this. And so it's very interesting to see kind of these dark themes played out in a very adult way, even though we're dealing with childhood issues. And it's visually, I think it definitely keeps up with that quality level.
Yeah, and you mentioned the voice actors. I think the voice acting in this movie is roundly great.
Yeah.
I think KW, Lauren Ambrose, I think is amazing. And I think Catherine O'Hara is so funny in this movie. Oh my God, she makes me laugh so hard.
Yeah, in a very like understated way. Like not just a lot of big laugh lines, but is able to pull it off and make it humorous.
Yeah, like I like Catherine O'Hara already. Like I don't need to be sold on the merits of one Miss O'Hara, but she is so good in this movie. Oh my God. Yeah, and you were talking about sort of the, we were talking about the visuals and how this is sort of about childhood. And one thing I really enjoyed about the visuals, well, okay, I'm unsure if I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the idea.
I noticed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the idea. They may have done it so many times that it's kind of comical, but the sun is always setting in this movie. and there's always sort of like this golden light. And I mean, it's not in every single scene, but it's in a weird percentage of scenes that there is either sunrise or sunset, and the light on these characters always just being sort of this gold light. And the theme of the sun is always very present. And in the movie, we talked about the speech that the teacher gives about the sun gonna die, which I find is funny, but is so important to the movie as well. And at one point, Max even asks Carol, "Did you know the sun is gonna die?" And Carol kind of denies it. And it's all about sort of things ending and things starting. And like most movies about youth of some sort, and it be they teens or younger like Max's age, there is sort of this idea that one thing is ending and another's beginning, and that's very much what Where the Wild Things Are is about. It's about sort of your childhood kind of ending and you sort of having to move on, and that's what the sun, the light in the movie is all about. It's sort of, I don't know, it's the whole nothing gold can stay. Like you can't stay in this light forever. You know, you gotta get into a new one. And and I feel like that's sort of very prevalent throughout the movie. And I like that they sort of they got that across visually, like tied in the sun so much in the dialogue and in the visuals. I just sort of feel like maybe they did the sunset too many times, but I should have counted, but I swear it's comical.
When I think of this movie kind of as a color, it's that gold. Like it's the same thing from the poster, which might be kind of skewing my opinion, but it's that desert sand / sunset that fully comes across.
Yeah, for sure.
At the beginning when Max is kind of having that snowball fight with everybody and before things go terribly, I think that's really like a really sweet moment. And as far as a movie kind of capturing the kind of free spirited, fun, joyous, immediate nature of childhood, like I can't think of any other sequences that do that really well, as well as is done in this movie. And
well, yeah. And even after that, when he's trying to call his mom into his fort, like the lava's coming, you know, like that.
it's so genuine, it's so sweet. And you know, you see kind of how much fun he's having and not even kind of thinking about anything else but what's immediately present and fun and enjoyable. And then we see him kind of take his rage out on his sister's room and break the frame and, you know, get snow all over room and just mess it up in general. And then he ends up telling his mother and, you know, she's upset with him and he understands that what he did was wrong. And then for the most of the movie is spent with the wild things is Max figuring out why he can't stay the way he is.
Yeah.
And you can't have these tantrums. You can't have these freakouts. It's so much part of childhood to go right from something so great and so fun to, you know, something so negative and so terrible. And most of the movie is just an examination of why acting that way is not a good thing to do. And like in children's literature, it just enforces the pro-social values of getting along with people and not being a piece of shit kid.
Mm-hmm.
As Carol, as Max's kind of wild thing stand-in, we see that him acting out in this way is hurting the people closest to him. And he kind of learns that what he did, you know, hurt his mother a lot, and he cares about his mother. And it's this very kind of grand, visually impressive metaphor for, you know, why you can't be a kid forever. Mm-hmm. And why is wonderful and is carefree and fantastic as that can be sometimes, it doesn't last, and it can't last in a way you don't want it to last, because when you're that concerned about just what's happening at the moment, you're not concerned about the people who are close to you that you're hurting by, you know, acting that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very, very gorgeous and complicated metaphor for why Max has to grow up. And eventually when he comes back and he's with his mother, and, you know, he has kind of a hot meal and the cake and the glass of milk and stuff, and she falls asleep just looking at him. I thought that was like one of the most touching moments of this whole movie.
Yeah, it's
just
great.
Absolutely. That, that comfort of, you know, being together and having your family together and happy. And he seems to have grown up on his little adventure away from home, and she's just happy to have him back. And maybe she doesn't understand the development he just went through, but just as a loving mother is there for him when he gets back.
Yeah. And one thing I love about that scene, I actually forgot that she falls asleep at the end of the scene. And like the second he walks into back into the home, I was like, wow, Catherine Keener looks so authentically tired. Like in a way that I had not seen in a movie before. And I thought that was, I was great. I assume she had been awake. Like she looks like she'd been awake for 20 hours and well done, Miss Keener. Like, I needed more reasons to like her, but I agree. I think that's a good scene. And I like the stuff that sort of leads up to that, to him leaving where the wild things are, and all those discussions he has with Alex and then KW. The rebirth is a bit much for me. But pretty much everything else is good. And what gets accomplished in that rebirth scene, I think, is good. The conversation he has with KW, and, you know, by proxy, his mother, I think is sort of a nice moment. The one thing I sort of find, you know, this movie is very much about coming of age. The one thing I sort of feel is different from this movie is the way Carol is treated at the very end. And the discussion with Alex, Max's last discussion with Alex is very important. And in that he's sort of saying, Alex says, I believe this is word for word, I don't even know if there is such a thing as a king that can do all the things you said. Like Max promises at the beginning. Look, I don't care. Just don't ever let Carol find that out. And I think that's this really great line. And it's very important that, you know, Carol is sort of a part of Max. And it's sort of like, keep that part of you alive, keep that fun alive, that creativity, that innocence. And even though Max and Carol aren't like the best of friends at the end of their this movie, that Carol sort of comes back to him on the beach is really important. Like, Max is sort of losing touch with Carol, his inner child, right? He's growing up, and they fight and they don't really make up. But sort of the end point and what matters about Carol running to the beach is that, when, you know, Max grows up, Carol will still be there screaming on the beach. Like, it'll still be deep inside him that this creativity, this sense of play. And I think that's great. And I think that's something that sort of makes it seem like a really personal movie to me, much more so than Spike Jonze's other films. This is the first film he's a credited screenwriter on. That's a big part of that. But I feel like that really sort of fits in with his career and his aesthetic and the way things work. And he's an adult, but he's always got this really like playful aspect to his movies. Even something like Adaptation or Being John Malkovich, which are
pretty heavy
very heavy movies, there's always sort of a sense of of joy to them, and in just at least some scenes or the way things are done, and
like all of Donald Kaufman in adaptation,
exactly, like, exactly
that sense you're trying to get across.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I just sort of think that that's the great accomplishment of Where the Wild Things Are is the not overdoing Carol. They kind of go a bit too far with KW, but I feel like KW and the mother, that's the type of thing I've seen in another movie. Whereas sort of this stand-in for your childhood creativity, I don't think I've seen that. And I think that's great. And as somebody that is now much more interested in the career of Spike Jonze than I was when I first saw this movie, I find it fascinating to watch and think about.
And yeah, it's for a movie about childhood, like it, I guess it's just important to note that I definitely agree he has that sense of play and that creativity and that kind of fun nature pervades all his, maybe not all, but most of his stuff, like the Sabotage video, the Fatboy Slim videos that he did. Like, they're so fun and goofy and like just Christopher Walken flying around dancing. Yeah. Like, that's incredible.
Yeah. And he sort of, his career has always been like, he's jumping from thing to thing. He's done so much, music videos, commercials,
skateboard company, magazines.
Jackass is a big part of that. Like, what's more childish than Jackass?
That's a good point.
And just sort of like even little things, like there was the LCD Sound System documentary, Shut Up and Play the Hits. Spike Jonze is a credited camera operator in that movie. Just cause, he did a documentary on Fat Lip, who's one of the rappers in the Far Side. There is this really like childish, and I don't mean childish in sort of a pejorative way, feel to Spike Jonze. Like it is a sense of play and like a fuckitness, if you will. it's sort of, he just wants to try some things and if they work, let it go. And I feel like the things he has tried in his career have sort of ended up being incredibly influential. Like, I spent most of yesterday watching Spike Jonze music videos, many of which I had seen a number of times because a lot of them are very famous music videos. But that sort of idea of throwing things out there and seeing what sticks was very present in most of his videos. And I mean, even there's some videos where it's just sort of, it's clearly, he enjoyed working with these guys previously, so they made a video for something that would never have a video. Like Ricky's Theme by the Beastie Boys is a video that's for a song that's like a minute and 40 seconds long. It's instrumental, like clearly not a single.
Yeah.
But it just seems like they had a good time on Sabotage, and what they did is dressed up the Beasties as old people that then played basketball against kids. And I mean, like, look at the Uncle Drew spots for Pepsi Max that are around now with Kyrie Irving. And this video came out in like 1993, and I think that's kind of interesting. And a lot of the things that Spike Jonze did in his music videos in the early 90s don't seem new anymore, but I'm sure they were. Like, there's so much of people rapping in slow motion, but like, keeping up with the lyrics, like, so they would speed up the actual track they were rapping to. And one of the videos, and this is the only time I've seen this done with in such a weird sort of long way, was the Sweater Song by Weezer. Yeah. They do that, and the band is playing all throughout, and it gives sort of this weird sort of off-kilter feel to the video. Yeah. And Sure Shot with the Beastie Boys is the first video I saw of him doing that, and it's great. Like, it's such a good effect that is done so often now. And, maybe not now, but was definitely adopted.
Yeah.
And certainly the reasoning behind Undone being the video that it was because they saw a Sure Shot, I'm certain of it. And even just outside of that, like, there's things like cameras being hooked onto a swing in the Sure Shot video and people just, like, grabbing it and swinging. Like, even people like Kanye West and Jay-Z, when they're in a Spike Jonze video, as they were for Otis, like, that's the most fun Kanye and Jay-Z have appeared to have in their entire careers.
Yeah.
And, like, Kanye is not somebody you see smiling very often. No. Or like Jay-Z, like, you see him laugh and stuff in interviews, but he's never cheesing for the camera.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing in this whole video. Yeah. And I watched that video like 5 times. I'd watch it again 5 more times. Like I love that video. And there's always sort of that really sort of joyful feel to his videos. You know?
Yeah. And I saw a quote from Marie Sendak, who, you know, wrote Where the Wild Things Are, the book. And Spike Jonze was his favorite for who was going to direct this movie. As I said, they'd mm-hmm. want to adapt it for a while, and kind of went through a lot of studios and kind of directors attaching their name to it. And Sendak said Spike Jonze was, quote, young, interesting, and had that spark that none of the others had. Mm-hmm. And I think that spark is that that playfulness and that fun. And he's definitely extremely talented, technically, and, you know, visually, things look great when he does them. But I think it's that you know, that playfulness and that ability to maintain some of his that childhood excitement and fun. Like, yeah, exactly. You don't see Jay-Z having fun like that. Like, it's something that you know, he brings to the table. And again, that the book is heavy and dark in a lot of ways, but Spike Jonze was someone who was able to kind of provide some balance, I think, of doing these fun, goofy, creative things, mm-hmm. which you would need in a movie about childhood, but also able to factor in these kind of bigger, heavier, grander ideas, and melding the two of them in an effective way that it's funny when it wants to be funny, and it's funny because it seemingly comes out of nowhere when it decides to be funny.
Yeah, and there's so many examples of Spike Jonze in music videos sort of doing things that are fun, but sort of have something at the end that sort of make it feel a bit more thought-provoking. Like, I told you about this Chemical Brothers video I watched yesterday for Electrobank that involves Sofia Coppola as a gymnast. And the whole thing is built around her just winning a gymnastics meet, I suppose. And but the end is her being held by her coach, and it turns into a still frame. And it's sort of like, zoom out from that still frame, and it's just sort of like one of those pictures that's in the hall of your high school, like in a trophy case.
Yeah.
And it's just people walking past it, paying no mind to it. And it's sort of like this super exciting, really great moment for her.
Yeah.
That just disappears. And yeah, I think that's really telling for Where the Wild Things Are. And the work that Spike Jonze has done with Arcade Fire, really, even more so, really hammers home the Wild Things stuff about childhood. Cause I mean, I don't think Win Butler's ever written a song that's not about the kids, and they really just sort of fit with that aesthetic. And, there's often some sort of feel to a video, that Spike does about kids. It's sort of about growing up a bit, and there's sort of a bit of melancholy to it. And, another one of my favorite videos of his is Sky's the Limit by the Notorious B.I.G. Have you ever seen this?
No.
Okay. So it's just like a standard, Biggie video. Like, it's like a Hype Williams 1990s rap video.
Yeah.
And it's just kids are playing every part. And, and the song, I mean, the song's called Sky's the Limit. It's all about dreams. And it's sort of the idea that, this is what Biggie was thinking of as a kid. And it's so funny because, like, even they're just sitting around watching a rap video, and it's supposed to be a Busta Rhymes video. Even the kid on the TV, like the Busta on the TV is played by a kid.
That's awesome.
They go to a club to meet up with Faith Evans, who's played by, like, everybody's kids. It's so much fun. And and I think the Puffy, when Puff Daddy the kid does the Puff Daddy dance, it's so funny. But that sort of, like, again, really fits in with sort of that the childish feel that Spike gives off so much.
I think that's, I haven't even seen that, but that sounds like absolutely a perfect summation of kind of what Spike Jonze has done with his career and why he was such a perfect choice for this movie.
Yeah, and you know, he sort of does a lot of things that would be considered sort of rule breaking. Like, I feel like not doing the Wild Things CGI in 2009.
Yeah.
That's kind of a rule break, you know, and things that don't necessarily make sense in theory. Like, if you're explaining it to somebody, like, adaptation's going to end with these flowers growing out, and we're going to do a lot of time lapse, and it's going to, like, sun is going to set and rise and set and rise and set and rise. Mm-hmm. And, these flowers are just going to blow in the wind the whole time. Like, it just seems like, really? What? And then it's perfect. Like, I talked about it on the adaptation podcast, that I think that scene is so perfect and probably the most perfect minute of Spike Jonze's career. But all these things that don't necessarily make sense, that end up being perfect, you know? Yeah. And even something as little as people rapping in slow motion along with the words, like, doesn't make sense, but it's so cool and so much fun. And he always tries to keep in touch with the real, like, practical effects whenever possible. And I think that is a feeling that is in Where the Wild Things Are that is definitely a part of his career,
you know,
all through.
Well, good for Spike.
Yeah, and now we got Her coming out. Very curious about this.
Yeah, me too. I was just reading about that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's set up to be super personal.
And it's kind of just with what you've been saying about how he's so good at walking the line and doing things that don't seem like a good idea. From the description, I'm not that excited about the movie. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that Spike Jones is involved and Joaquin Phoenix, who I think is doing a lot of good stuff lately. I'm excited for it for those reasons.
And one of the other things that Spike is really good at is looking at things in a different way, like sort of just average things in a different way. Like, did you ever see this IKEA commercial he did with the lamp?
Yeah, I think I saw it a while ago. I just read about it again.
Yeah, it's great. It's just built around sort of this, the idea being that someone's throwing out their old IKEA lamp, and it's made to make, you know, the music's kind of mournful and all this, and the old lamp is looking in at the new lamp, and then some Swedish guy at the end comes and just totally breaks the fourth wall. It's like, you think you care for this lamp, but you shouldn't. It's old. The new one is much better. and it's just an IKEA ad. And I think that's something that Spike Jones is really good at, just sort of looking at something as simple as like a lamp and just finding a new look at it. And I think Her is going to be that to a T. And the fact that Joaquin Phoenix's character is divorced, not unlike Spike Jones, is it's going to be very interesting. Like, Sofia Coppola's already commented on her divorce with Lost in Translation, so now it's Spike's turn. I find that...
She denies that. But...
She denies it, but she's wrong.
You hear that, Sofia? You're wrong.
Yeah. Her's going to be a good time, so I'm interested in it.
Me too.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. We're going to be taking a week off. We'll be back with... We actually haven't discussed what our next topic will be. It's between two things, but we won't tell you what those two things are, so you don't get excited for the one we don't do.
Why don't you email us your ideas?
There's always that. Twitter is probably a better way to get us ideas. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, tell your friends, Pinterest, all that stuff. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.